This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a Western woman in the Middle East, Geraldine Brooks was bewildered by the place of women in the Islamic world. In Saudi Arabia, women lead secluded lives and are not allowed to drive. Yet in several predominantly Muslim countries, such as Pakistan, Turkey, and Bangladesh, women have been elected prime minister. This disparity indicated to Brooks that Islam didn't have to mean the oppression of women. So why were so many Muslim women oppressed? She tried to learn as much as she could about the lives of Muslim women while she reported from the Middle East for the Wall Street Journal from 1987 to 1992. Now she's written a new book called Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women. At one time, she was thinking of naming her book The Prophet's Daughters. A leader of the militant fundamentalist group Hezbollah warned her not to use that title. I asked her what he found offensive.
I think it wasn't even so much the title, but the fact that the book was going to purport to discuss the family life of the Prophet Muhammad and to look at how events in the Prophet's own life then went on to shape the lives of Islamic women. And that the book still does that in exactly the same way that it was always intended to. The change of title was purely for personal reasons. I thought that when I read the hadith or saying of Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali ibn Abu Talib, who became the founder of the Shiite sect of Islam, he was talking about women's sexuality. And he said, Almighty God created sexual desire in 10 parts, then gave 9 parts to women and 1 to men. I was so blown away by that thought that it just seemed to me that title explained so much about women that was a much better title for the book.
Well, before we get to an explanation of what that saying means and how you interpreted it, I'm just wondering with the Hezbollah leader if that disturbed you at all, that he had troubles with what you intended to explore in the book.
I think it comes very much from the aftermath of the Salman Rushdie fatwa, and I think a chill descended on all people who were trying to study or write about Islam, that there was an idea around for quite some time and probably still around in many places that Muslims somehow had the right not to be offended and that you mustn't therefore explore any of the ideas that are central to the faith. And I think that's a misunderstanding of one of the real strengths of the faith, which is, unlike Christianity, Muslims don't say that Prophet Muhammad was anything other than a human being. And in the Quran itself, God criticizes Muhammad. In the early days of Islam, there was always a back and forth between Muhammad and his followers. And the right to discuss and to criticize was there in the early days of Islam. So I don't see why it should be pulled away now by a few modern leaders of the faith.
Let me get back to the title of your book, Nine Parts of Desire, which comes from the quote, Almighty God created sexual desire in 10 parts, then he gave 9 parts to women and 1 to men. Are there different interpretations of what that means?
I don't think there's different interpretations about what it means, what it leads to. It sort of leads in two very different directions. What it means is that Islam acknowledges that women are sexual beings, that they have a right to sexuality. It's a God-given gift. And that can lead you in two directions. It can lead you to say that because they're such sexual beings, they have to be controlled and contained. Or it can lead you to say, listen, God's given this sexuality to women, let's treasure it, let's enjoy it. Let's certainly not bring into Islam teachings from other cultures that say women's genitals must be mutilated to the point where they can't ever get any pleasure from sex. How you can bring that into a faith that has this as one of its earliest teachings seems to me a very strange thing that the two have become conflated.
In your book, you write that you are constantly bewildered by the contradictions between repression and sexual license through the Middle East. Maybe you could give us an example of what you mean.
Well, because Islam appreciates human sexuality, Muhammad in his sayings and in his own life, he was always stressing that he hadn't come with a message of monasticism. In Islam, celibacy is not an exalted state. It's considered profoundly unnatural, and you don't aspire to be celibate. You aspire to be married and to express your sexuality within the rules of marriage. And I used to contrast it with the Roman Catholic tradition that I grew up in, where we were raised on St. Paul. St. Paul's message that marriage was very much a second choice for the weak-willed. You should be celibate. But if you felt that you couldn't be celibate, then marry, because it's better to marry than to burn. Well, Islam teaches something entirely different to that. It teaches that within marriage, basically anything goes. You and your husband should enjoy each other, and that a woman has right to sexual pleasure. Muhammad taught that foreplay was very important. When he was speaking once about cruelty, he said, "Sex without foreplay is cruelty to women."
You interviewed one Saudi oil executive who told you that he thought that the American obsession with sexual equality was really just a front for immorality. And then he asked if he could introduce you to some of his friends, and he took you to meet his friends at a disco with half-naked women dancers. And how do you reconcile those two things?
I was stunned by this. This guy, I'd had an interview with him, and this was at the time of the Gulf War, and he'd also told me that he thought it was appalling and disgusting that CNN had sent a woman reporter to cover the war, because, you know, there she was on TV in the holy soil of Saudi Arabia. And then, you know, this little disco room was in his own house, and it had flashing lights and a terrific sound system and a well-stocked bar, which is completely illegal in Saudi Arabia and illegal in Islam to be drinking alcohol. And he was sitting there swishing the scotch round in his glass and telling me how he'd hired a prostitute to go to Switzerland skiing with him. And I didn't know for a long time how he could hold these two completely contradictory ideas in his mind. And then I got a little bit of insight into it when I was reading Naguib Mahfouz's novel Palace Walk. And the patriarch character in that book is very strict husband who sequesters his wife and his daughters, and who's a devout Muslim who prays. But he also goes out whoring with the women entertainers of Cairo. And when the local sheikh in the novel admonishes him for this behavior, he says, "Well, you know that in the early days of Islam, Muslims were free to have as much sex as they liked with their slave girls and their war captives, and these women entertainers are just our modern equivalent of those." And I think that for that Saudi guy, the women that were dancing in his little disco room were also an equivalent of those kind of non-Muslim, or if Muslim, so lapsed that it doesn't matter. But in any case, they were not Saudi women. And he was drawing a line between the women of the faith and the kafir or the infidel women, and it didn't matter how you treated them.
You assume that women who wore the veil were at least free from the beauty industry, but in your travels you learned that even that wasn't true.
That was an extremely naive assumption on my part. I thought, well, one good thing about being veiled from head to foot is you won't have to bother about shaving your legs. But then I found that actually one of the amazing things about Islam is that it touches every part of life, and one of the consequences of the teaching of the value of sex in marriage is that as a woman you should be really beautiful for your husband. And culturally, most Muslims consider body hair unbeautiful, in fact sexually repulsive. In most Muslim countries that I visited, it's Islamically recommended for women to remove all their body hair every 20 days, and for men every 40 days. And before you go to your wedding, you'll be completely depilated, usually using a paste of honey and lemon, and all the hair will come off. So if you see somebody, a veiled woman, and she doesn't pluck her eyebrows, that probably means she's single, because a married woman will probably be quite particular about that. So women spend a great deal of time looking wonderful. And I got my biggest shock in this regard when I went to interview some of the women of Hezbollah. and I'd met them in public, and all I could see was a tiny little triangle with basically just nose, eyes, and a little bit of lip. And then when I went to meet them in their room, I knocked on the door, and when the woman opened it, I thought, oh, I've got the wrong room here, because she was wearing a beautiful sheer silk nightgown with a plunge neckline, and she had streaked blonde hair right down to her waist, and she was a knockout. And the other women in the room were equally elaborately done up, and they laughed at me, and they said, you know, of course we hide ourselves from people to whom it would be immodest to show ourselves, but at home, for each other and for our husbands, of course we want to be as beautiful as we can.
So the pressure of being beautiful is still on. You just have to cover up in public.
In fact, it's probably on more because there's always, in some countries, polygamy is still quite common. Islam allows men to take up to 4 wives, and although it's becoming less common as time goes on, it's still a threat that hangs over a woman that if she's not beautiful, her husband might go out and find a young, lovely wife and set up a separate housekeeping with her. And it's a little like the Western male midlife crisis, you know, the older wife or the wife of the youth being shunted aside for this younger one.
My guest is Geraldine Brooks. She's the author of the new book, 9 Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women. And it's based on her journeys through the Middle East when she was reporting there for the Wall Street Journal. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about Islamic women. My guest is Geraldine Brooks, author of the new book, 9 Parts of Desire. When you were traveling through the Middle East reporting for the Wall Street Journal, you were traveling with your husband, but you were often alone, especially when you were on assignment. What was the range of attitudes that you got from government officials and from other interviewees as a Western woman alone?
There's quite a wide range of reactions. I didn't have too much trouble with government officials in the Middle East because a lot of them are Western educated, or at least they've spent time in the West or understand what Western women are about. What frustrated me at first was that I wasn't really free to do the kind of street level reporting, the sort of, I like to report from the bottom up rather than the top down. And when I went out in the streets or in the coffee shops and just started talking to strange men, their reactions would be either complete embarrassment, or they saw it as an opportunity to test a widely held assumption that Western women are whores. And and this came from the fact that in many of the Gulf countries, particularly, men just don't routinely speak to women that they're not related to. So I was a bit of an anomaly there.
When you say that men would test the assumption that Western women are whores, would they come on to you as you tried to interview them?
Yes, because, you know, interviewing is about forming a rapport and being very interested in what someone has to say. And for some of these guys, this was the first time that a woman had been smiling at them, listening to them, leaning forward. You just don't do that. And I had to completely modify my approach and learn to be very reserved, which is not great interviewing technique. And so it wasn't until I actually started talking to women and then getting to know their husbands through the wives and through the relationship I already had with the wives, that things became much easier for me.
When you were interviewing a man who misinterpreted your curiosity and thought that you were coming on to him and he started to come on to you, what would you do?
You'd just have to be very unpleasant and just sort of shut the whole conversation down and leave as quickly as you possibly could.
You went to the Middle East with your husband, Tony Horowitz, who's also a writer and journalist. What interested you the most about what he could do that you couldn't do in certain Middle East countries?
Well, again, in the beginning, he, being a guy, had no trouble talking to guys. So I was absolutely disheartened after about 6 months when I was going through our clipping book where we took our articles and pasted them up. And he would have great sounding headlines like Egyptian camel core tracks smugglers through the desert, and life on a supply boat in the mine-strewn waters of the Persian Gulf. And I would see those and just see red because I wasn't able, the Egyptian army wouldn't send a woman out on patrol with the Camel Corps, and the shipping agents in the Gulf wouldn't let a woman go out on a dhow, on a supply boat. So, you know, I was feeling very envious of him. But then once I started exploring the lives of women, I began to have my own adventures, and things equalized a little bit.
Well, not only couldn't you go riding with the Camel Corps, you couldn't get a hotel room by yourself in Saudi Arabia.
That's right. I actually ended up getting arrested for having the temerity to try and check into a hotel by myself. The clerk on the desk said it was illegal for women to travel alone in Saudi Arabia without official permission from the police, because the only possible reason that a woman could be alone was if she was a prostitute. So I ended up spending much of that night in the Dhahran police station while a young police lieutenant perused every piece of identification I had and finally gave me permission to spend the last few hours of what was left of the night in that hotel. And when I got back there, they took me to a completely empty floor with an armed guard posted at the elevator.
Were you angry by then, or were you used to it?
By the time that one happened, I was pretty used to it, and I kind of had, at first there was kind of a burning anger when I'd see how women were treated, and I let that sometimes affect my behavior. But then I realized, hey, you know, you're not here as some kind of avenging sword of Western feminism, you're here to find out what's going on, and one way to find out what's going on is to be subjected to some of these things yourself. So I began to sort of take it in stride and try and see everything as a learning experience.
You traveled with a veil. For what occasions would you actually put it on?
Sometimes if you were interviewing somebody from Islamic Jihad or Hezbollah, a man, they would feel uncomfortable sitting in a room with a woman who wasn't covered. And so I'd wear it on request. And in Iran, the law is that all women, whatever their religious faith, have to be covered. The rule is you can show your hands and face, but all hair and all curves of the body have to be covered up somehow. And how you do that's pretty much up to you. But I found that the chador was kind of the easiest all-purpose garment to wear.
You converted to Judaism when you married your husband because he's Jewish. You were brought up Roman Catholic. And when you got married, you had no idea you'd eventually be stationed in the Middle East, where a lot of people would think of you as being the enemy because you were Jewish. What was your attitude toward when and how and if to reveal to people that you were Jewish?
I only denied being Jewish once very early on in my time in the Middle East, and it was just a sort of a nervous impulse because of all the stereotypes that I'd heard about how Arabs particularly felt about Jews. And I felt so cowardly and just disgusted with myself for doing that I made a rule after that no matter what the circumstances were, if somebody asked me a direct question, I would tell them the truth. And so that was what I did. And most of the time, it didn't come up.
In your acknowledgments, you thank Deborah Amos, Christian Amanpour, Nora Bustani, Jackie Leiden, and Milton Viorst for good company in war zones. Everyone in that list except for Milton Viorst is a woman. And I was wondering if you sought out the company of women journalists during the Gulf War or whether you were coincidentally with them.
This was something that I learned from Muslim women, because from the time I left my old girls high school to get my first job, which was as a cadet in the sports department on of an Australian newspaper, my career always pushed me into a man's world. And it wasn't until I started, you know, really seeking out Muslim women and spending time with them and entering their wonderfully sort of feminine, sisterly company that I realized that I personally hadn't made a close woman friend since I'd left high school. And I thought, you know, there's something wrong with this picture. And then I did start to seek them out, thank God, you know.
So you sought out the company of other women journalists?
Yes, that's right, and continue to seek out the company of other women because I realized that it was a gap that had developed in my life and I hadn't even noticed it until by spending time with Muslim women I saw the kinds of deep, deep sisterly friendships that they had and realized that they were at that time missing in my life.
What was the turning point for you in deciding that you were going to make women a focus of your reporting in the Middle East?
It came during the first year when we were based in Cairo, and I had a news assistant there, an Egyptian woman. When I arrived, she'd already been working for the journal for a couple of years. She was a couple of years younger than me, very sophisticated, beautiful, precise, formal English, wonderful hairdos, very stylish, lots of makeup. And she seemed an entirely Western figure to me in some ways. She was a graduate and she was planning to do postgraduate studies at Harvard and she was admitted there. Suddenly, after I'd known her for about a year, it was Ramadan, the holy month when Muslims fast from dawn to dusk, and she arrived for work the first morning of Ramadan completely veiled. The elaborate curls were gone under a severe blue scarf. The makeup was scrubbed away. Instead of the fashionable clothes, she was wearing a dowdy sort of a sack. And I just stared at her. I was stunned because up until then, my assumption had been that people who embraced Orthodox Islam or fundamentalist Islam were the desperate cases, the really poor people, the people who were looking for some heavenly solace to make up for the grimness of their lives. Well, Saha's life was not grim and she had lots of choices and that was the choice she made. And that was what really started me asking the question, why Saha?
And why? I mean, what answers have you come up with?
I think that there are a number of answers. On the political level, I think people like Saha, well-educated people, have seen their countries going down the tubes for years under first, in the case of Egypt, socialism that was imported from the Soviet Union. I think Saha had seen Western systems embraced in Egypt. She'd seen socialism embraced. None of them had brought any answers. And so she started to look for something of her own. And she said, what's our own? Islam's ours, and we should try Islam.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Geraldine Brooks is the author of Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.